As Joe said, the topic of this lecture is on endocrine disruption in fish, primarily from wastewater-borne hormones. The problem is that we're releasing hormones and hormone-mimicking substances into our waters, and they're causing negative effects on the fish and the wildlife, and possibly even ourselves. And the link on this page here is one that I've placed on the bottom of one of those handouts. It takes you to a 2004 report done by NBC on the white suckers in Colorado. The outline for today's topic is going to be endocrine disruption as hormones as contaminants. We'll go over a brief history of endocrine disrupting chemicals. We'll look at some documented effects on fish. We'll ask, look at the question, are there any human effects? And then where do we go from here, or what's next? But before we can address endocrine disruption, we first have to look at the endocrine system. The endocrine system is that part of the body that regulates the immune, the metabolic, the morphogenic, the neural, and the reproductive functions. It does this by having glands that secrete hormones which attach to receptors on target cells throughout the body. This in turn triggers a response. So an endocrine disruptor is going to be anything that interferes with this process in any way, either from the synthesis all the way to the elimination of that hormone from the body. Endocrine disruption can come from natural endocrine disruptors like phytoestrogens, which are hormone-mimicking substances naturally occurring in over 300 plant species, such as clover, wheat, apples, and cherries. Synthetic or man-made chemicals can also be sources of endocrine disruption. Many people are familiar with the herbicides, the fungicides, insecticides, and PCBs as contaminants, so I only want to look at these last three here momentarily. Alkyl phenols are commonly found in personal care products and detergents that we use every day. They're also located in a number of plastics. TCDD and TCDF are stable dioxins that are released into the environment from the byproducts of paper and wood industry. And pharmaceuticals are increasingly becoming a problem, especially birth control, which I'll mention momentarily. The biggest problem is that between these chemicals, there have been no structural similarities that have been found. So this makes it very hard when you're trying to locate other endocrine disrupting chemicals. EDCs were first produced in the 1930s, with the first effects on reproduction being seen in 1938. In the 1950s, we saw an increase in the use of the drug DES, which was given to women to help prevent miscarriages. Unfortunately, this was later shown to cause decreased fertility in their offspring. In the 1960s, we saw the documentation of the negative effects of DDT. In 1976, the British Water Research Center published a paper recognizing steroids as a form of water pollution. In 1991, the term endocrine disruptor was first coined, and in 1996, EPA identified endocrine disruption as one of its six main priorities. In the last 10 years, there have been over 500 published papers by EPA alone on this topic. Some of these endocrine disruptors can have hormonal origins. Estrogens are of particular concern because they have a small size and they're highly organic, so they can easily be absorbed by suspended sediment and therefore transport considerable distances, affecting more organisms. Of the most concern is 17-alpha ethanyl estradiol, which is EE2, or birth control. This form is especially dangerous because it is released from wastewater treatment plants in an active form. It is extremely stable in the environment and is often found at levels above its lowest observable effect limit. Environmental concerns from testosterone come from fertilized or cattle grades fields because, unlike estrogens, testosterone binds loosely to the soils and can quickly reach groundwaters. The persistence of hormonal contaminants is often much longer than other contaminants. Also, they can concentrate on the land and be flushed out in large doses during the rainy seasons. This is of a particular threat because increased rains can sometimes correspond with fish spawning seasons. Wastewater treatment plants are the primary sources for the release of hormonal contaminants. But non-point sources such as agricultural runoff and sewage effluent that is used for irrigation and crop fields can also be a source. But most people want to know, well, what are the effects of the wildlife? Well, to look at a few, we see the feminized behavior mainly in the nesting characteristics of certain gull species across the country. Also, the demasculinization and the superfeminization of American alligators in Florida, demasculinized Florida panthers, as well as demasculinized adult and juvenile male otters in the Columbia River, just to name a few. But since this is a fish talk, what's happening to the fish? Well, masculinization as well as feminization occurs in fish that have been exposed to estrogen or hormones and hormone mimics. The masculinized effects, we see the early maturing of the males. We also see the smaller female body size and smaller offspring and less offspring in the females. And when you're looking at the feminized effects, delayed sperm and egg development. We also see smaller testes as well as eggs on the testes for the males, and also an increase in production of female protein vitellogenin, both in the males as well as the females. So the question is, why are these fish supposedly more affected than other wildlife? Well, the main problem is that there's no escape for their fish. They're constantly surrounded by these contaminants at all times, and they have no choice to get away. Also, it's been documented that there's bioconcentration effects from these EDCs, which means that even low doses over a long period of time can negatively impact these fish. To look at some specific examples, start with the roach fish, which is a native of Europe and West Asia. In 1985, anglers began catching hermaphroditic fish downstream from sewage treatment plants in London. So what researchers did was they took rainbow trout and they caged them downstream from these same treatment plants. What they found was that the vitellogenin production in the males increased on a dose-dependent level. So if you had an increase in chemical release, you had the same increase in vitellogenin production. They also documented that every sewage treatment plant investigated was releasing increased levels of estrogen. In 96, USGS released a study that they had been doing on carp on 26 streams in 11 river basins across the U.S. They measured levels of estrogen, testosterone, and vitellogenin in all the carp that were caught. And what they found was that all the carp within all the river basins, some of the carp within all the river basins showed signs of endocrine disruption. This was primarily in the form of estrogen testosterone ratios being off. There have been studies done on large and smallmouth, and what we see here in 2002 in the headwaters of the Potomac, they began seeing fish die-offs. So they went to investigate it, and upon internal investigation, they began finding intersexed male fish. So in the spring of 2003, they began looking specifically for endocrine disruption. What they found was that 80 to 100% of the smallmouth bass, the male smallmouth bass, were producing immature eggs. Also, down by D.C., 13 largemouth were caught. Seven of these 13 showed feminized characteristics. And of the three here, three of the seven were actually producing eggs. In 2007, a research study was done on the effects of gametes, of rainbow trout. What these researchers did was they exposed the gametes at different stages to EE2, which was the birth control mentioned earlier. And what they found was that prior to the initiation of spermatogenesis, the embryo survival was not affected. However, during late spermatogenesis, embryo survival was significantly reduced. In 2007, a study was released on fathead minnows, and this is one of the handouts that I've given you. This was on population level effects in this species. What these researchers did was they added EE2, or the birth control, for three consecutive years to a 34-hectare lake in Ontario. And what they found was that after only 7 weeks, vitellogenin production began to increase. And more significantly, if you look on the bottom, these are the male levels of vitellogenin production. They are oftentimes greater than those of the females. Degenerated ovarian follicles have also been found in these fathead minnows, as well as you can see the immature eggs on the testes of the males. But this population study, this study was originally developed as a population level study. And so if you look on the left side, we see the reference lake, and on the right, we see the study lake. So in a matter of from 99 to 2005, we saw a dramatic decrease in the catch per unit effort from 180 to 0.1. So essentially we had a collapse in this fish population. Well, a lot of people, they see these effects and the concern is that, well, how's this going to affect me? Well, as you can see, the endocrine disruption from sewage effluent has been theorized to be linked to the supposed decline in sperm counts of adult males, as well as the younger age for the onset of puberty, and also the increased incidence for both prostate and breast cancer. So these charts here are from the National Cancer Institute, and it shows a positive trend for prostate cancer in men, as well as a slight trend for breast cancer in women from 1975 to 2003. Although these positive trends are shown here, there has not been any link directly to the endocrine disrupting chemicals so far in the effluent. However, some people are on the offensive and they do not want to take the chance. As you can see, the makers of the drug Estroblaster are going to tell us, guys, the biggest problem is that we're being feminized and we don't even know it. So where do we go from here, or what's the next step? We want to address wastewater treatment first. Current removal methods that wastewater treatment plants have, listed here in decreasing effectiveness order, are going to be membrane biological reactors, activated sludge process with nutrient removal, trickling filtration, and then of least effectiveness are going to be those untreated areas, especially in undeveloped countries. The problem is that current methods only remove 40 to 90% of the EDCs in our wastewater. Some problems that wastewater treatment plants have to deal with. Oftentimes, because of the processes that they use to get rid of other chemicals, the hormones or the hormone mimics can come in a non-active form, but actually be released into the environment in an active form. Also, wastewater treatment plants have to deal with the fact that the mixtures of these chemicals are often more potent than the chemical themselves. We've also seen an increase in pharmaceutical usage over the past few years. And what we've seen here is that we have a number of drugs that are developed to treat symptoms, and they do not have curative properties. And so you have more people taking more drugs over longer periods of time. These drugs are then just subsequently dumped into the system, and the wastewater treatment plants have to deal with that. Also, a number of these pharmaceuticals are naturally derived from plants, and that makes it also harder for the treatment plants to break down. As of 2003, there were no regulations or laws for wastewater treatment plants enforcing them or causing them to have to deal with this issue of endocrine disruption. And then even if they wanted to, a number of the municipalities do not have the money to do these updates. Some future work that needs to be done in this area, we need to have better treatment methods for the wastewater treatment plants. We also need to have a better list or an updated list of possible endocrine disrupting chemicals. We need to study population level effects on longer lived species than just the fathead minnow, which only lives 2 to 4 years. And also, we need to have an understanding of the mechanism of interactive chemical effects, which is one of the other handouts I have in the handouts is a study done on the effects of mixtures of chemicals added to EE2. However, just because we don't know enough so far to link endocrine disruption directly to all these other problems, it doesn't mean that we don't need to do anything. Because as the precautionary principle states, that where there are threats of serious or irreversible damage, scientific uncertainty shall not be used to postpone cost-effective measures to prevent environmental degradation. And so with that, I'll take any questions.
Has there been any discussion of fish consumption advisory levels based on these things? I mean, the ones I know of will do the mercury and stuff like that.
The question was, have there been any studies or releases on advisories of not eating these fish that have been exposed to these chemicals? And I have not come across anything in my research. I did see some issues with dioxins, and dioxins are an endocrine disrupting chemical, but they're not directly related to hormones or hormone mimics. Yes, sir.
How much of an effect does this have on a given species, depending on the origin of the chemical, the species of origin? I mean, are the interspecific effects any greater than the within species effects? Are humans more or less effective than fish would be?
Well, the question was, if I can summarize it, are there any species-specific effects, or is one species more affected than another species? Well, humans usually have a larger size than most of the wildlife, and especially the fish, and so it's going to take a larger amount of the chemical to affect us. And also, you have seen, or they have done studies on the effects of certain fish being more likely to have a negative impact because of these chemicals. I don't know if they have related it to species origin or not, but there are certain species that are more impacted. And this can cause a problem because you see if one species is competing for another species and they're about on equal ground, if you introduce this chemical and one's going to be a little bit stronger, then it could possibly cause a localized extinction due to the impacts of competition and not just the exposure to the chemical.
So if they could trap all of these chemicals with the treatment, how long would it take for the amount that are in the water now to sort of break down? How long do they persist in the environment? Say we could stop it tomorrow, would there still be effects in 10 more years or 5 more years or what?
The question was, how long are these chemicals going to persist? If we're able to take them out of the system right now, those that are still there, how long are they going to stay around? Well, most of it breaks down naturally in the environment. It just takes longer than other chemicals. There was a study done in Israel in 2004 where they studied the distance that it travels, and essentially EE2, the birth control, it went for about 46 hectares, I believe, it's a kilometer. And so it went for about 46 kilometers as opposed to one of the natural ones that only went about 6. And so they persist longer, but they still break down. And the breakdown is increased usually in the summer months when you have increased heat and rains. They break down faster.
Let's give Josh a round of applause.